I'm Nikki Strong, and this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Take a look inside.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today, Jill Robbins and Mario Ritter Jr. tell us how the conflict in Sudan has connections that stretch to many parts of the world. Katie Weaver presents this week's Health and Lifestyle Report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series. But first,
foreign governments have evacuated hundreds of diplomats and other citizens from Sudan since Sunday. For Sudanese, the evacuation is a sign that international powers expect conditions to worsen in the North African nation. The fighting between forces loyal to two top Sudanese generals has killed over 420 and injured more than 3,700. The country is at risk of collapse, and the fighting could affect others far beyond its borders. The leaders of the two fighting forces are General Abdel Fattah Burhan, head of the armed forces, and General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, of a paramilitary group known as the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. The two generals came to power after pro-democracy protests led to the 2019 ouster of longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir. In 2021, the two joined forces to seize power from a civilian government. In recent months, negotiations were underway for a return to a democratic political system. Tensions between Burhan and Dagalo worsened during negotiations to reach a final agreement. The main dispute is over how the RSF would be mixed into the military and who would have control over fighters and weapons. Alex Duvall is a Sudan expert at Tufts University. He wrote in a note to colleagues this week that the conflict should be seen as the first round of a civil war.
Sudan is Africa's third largest country by area. The country uneasily shares the waters of the Nile River with Egypt and Ethiopia. Egypt relies on the Nile to support its population of over 100 million. Ethiopia is working on a huge dam to contain water upstream. Egypt has close ties to Sudan's military, which it sees as an ally against Ethiopia. Egypt has contacted both sides in Sudan to press for a ceasefire, but Egypt is unlikely to stand by if the military faces defeat. Sudan borders five other countries: Libya, Chad, the Central African Republic, Eritrea, and South Sudan. Nearly all of them face internal conflict, with different rebel groups operating along the borders. What happens in Sudan will not stay in Sudan, said Alan Boswell of the International Crisis Group. Chad and South Sudan look most immediately at risk of potential spillover, but the longer the fighting drags on, the more likely it is we see major external intervention. Arab Gulf countries have looked to Africa in recent years as they have sought to project power across the area. The United Arab Emirates has close ties to the Rapid Support Forces. The group sent thousands of fighters to aid the UAE and Saudi Arabia in their war against Iran-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen.
Russia has long had plans to build a naval base at Port Sudan that could support up to 300 troops and four ships. The Red Sea port is on the busy trading route for energy shipments to Europe. The Wagner Group is a Russian mercenary organization with close ties to Russian President Vladimir Putin's government. The group has been operating in Sudan since 2017. The United States and the European Union have established economic measures against two Wagner-linked companies. The gold mining companies were accused of smuggling. Sudan became an outsider nation when it sheltered Osama bin Laden and other militants in the 1990s. Omar al-Bashir, the country's ruler at the time, had led a hardline Islamist government. Sudan's isolation deepened over the conflict in western Darfur in the 2000s. At the time, the Sudanese forces and tribal fighters were accused of carrying out war crimes while suppressing a local rebellion. The International Criminal Court later charged al-Bashir with genocide. The U.S. removed Sudan from its list of state supporters of terrorism after the government in Khartoum agreed to establish ties with Israel in 2020. But billions of dollars in loans and aid were suspended after the 2021 military takeover. The lack of foreign support, inflation, and the war in Ukraine have all hurt Sudan's economy.
Armed groups in Sudan have long enriched themselves through the control of minerals and other natural resources. Dagalo has large farm animal holdings and gold mining operations. He is also believed to have been paid by Gulf countries for the RSF's services in fighting rebels in Yemen. The Sudanese military under Burhan controls much of the country's economy. It also depends on businessmen who grew rich during al-Bashir's long rule. Dewal of Tufts University said, "Control over money is as important as over the battlefield. The military will want to take control of gold mines and smuggling routes. The RSF will want to interrupt major transport arteries, including the road from Port Sudan to Khartoum," he said. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
Gardening requires a lot of physical labor. The activity can extend from light exercise to heavy labor. All that bending, lifting, digging, carrying, and moving burns calories and builds muscle. But it can also injure the body. A gardener's back can start to hurt, and so can their knees. Even the strongest and healthiest of gardeners can hurt themselves. For people who are less physically fit, or who have health conditions that limit movement or cause pain, gardening may seem impossible. But there are ways to grow plants that are gentle on the body, says expert Jessica Damiano. She recently provided some advice on the subject in a report for the Associated Press. Damiano said she uses heating pads on her neck and lower back for about 5 minutes before starting to garden. This helps to prepare her muscles for work. A few minutes of gentle stretching helps too. Try to collect all the tools you will need before settling in to your labor. It is also a good idea to store the heaviest equipment on waist-height shelves for the safest and easiest removal and return. Taking simple care in the way you lift and carry the objects you need can prevent injury. Remember to bend at the knees when lifting bags of mulch. You can stand with your feet as far apart as your shoulders to keep your balance. If bending at all is too difficult, or if you garden while seated, grow plants in raised beds that are as tall as your chair or the middle part of your body. You also can grow plants in towers or on trellises. Use wheelbarrows to transport heavy supplies. It is easy to overestimate your ability to carry heavy loads. The result can lead to injury. When you carry weight on your own, hold heavy objects to your chest, keeping your back as straight as possible. Plant containers can be very heavy. It is best to set containers where you want them before you fill them. Damiano's flower garden contains mostly perennials. She likes them better than annuals, which need replanting every year. That lessens her work and bending a great deal. Plus, perennials, which return year after year, usually cost more at first, but over time save money because you are not buying new annuals every spring. Move around on a garden seat with wheels. You can also use pads to protect your knees. If you have hand pain or difficulty holding on to things, many tools now come with improved grips. You can also update your existing tools with grips and wraps made to fit them. Most importantly, take it slow and easy. Limit gardening periods to between 60 and 90 minutes. I'm Katie Weaver.
And that was this week's Health and Lifestyle Report, presented by Katie Weaver. I'm happy to have Katie join me now to talk about some of the phrases we heard in the report. Hi, Katie. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Ashley. It's good to talk with you. You know, this story made me think about the ways Americans talk about health, the body, and exercise. We use many terms that seem simple, but might not be simple, to English learners.
True. It has been the subject of at least two of our Everyday Grammar programs.
You're right. I remember those stories included prepositional phrases, like in shape and out of shape, which can describe a person's physical condition. I know you have done a little gardening here and there, Ashley. Do you think it helps you stay in good shape?
For sure. I know the weightlifting part of gardening work can make you stronger and keep you in good shape. It is important to warm up a little before you start doing gardening work, as the report suggests.
Warm up. You just used a great phrasal verb. Gardening expert Jessica Damiano said she warms up before gardening by gently stretching her muscles, for example.
Well, thanks again for joining me today, Katie. I hope to have you back on soon for more tips for gardeners of all levels.
You're welcome. It was great being here.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Germany's attack on Poland and the start of World War II in Europe presented a problem for Americans in September of 1939. The United States, by law, was neutral, and few Americans had any desire to fight in another world war. But most Americans did not like Germany's Nazi leader, Adolf Hitler. They hoped for victory for Britain, France, and the other Allied powers. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt made this clear in a radio broadcast to Americans soon after the war began.
The overwhelming masses of our people seek peace. Peace at home. And the kind of peace in other lands which will not jeopardize our peace at home. We have certain ideas and certain ideals of national safety, and we must act to preserve that safety today and to preserve the safety of our children in future years. That safety is and will be bound up with the safety of the Western Hemisphere and of the seas adjacent thereto. We seek to keep war from our own firesides by keeping war from coming to the Americas.
He praised the British and other allies. Finally, the president called on Congress to change the neutrality laws that prevented him from sending arms to the Allies to help them fight Germany. Congress agreed to change the laws so foreign nations could buy American arms. In the months that followed, Hitler and his allies claimed one victory after another. German and Soviet troops captured Poland quickly in September of 1939. Then Soviet forces invaded the small Baltic nations of Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania. In late November, they attacked Finland. Fighting between Finland and the Soviet Union continued through the winter until Finland accepted Russia's demands. Fighting grew even more fierce the following spring in 1940. Germany attacked Denmark and Norway, defeating them easily. In May, German forces struck like lightning through Belgium and Holland. Within one day, they were in France. British and French forces were unable to stop the Germans from moving deep into northern France. The British finally had to flee from the European continent. They sailed back to Britain from the French town of Dunkirk. German soldiers marched through France, and Italian forces joined them by invading France from the south. Soon, Paris fell.
Verwundeten. die ihr Blut für diesen herrlichen Sieg gaben, der überall an der Front wie in der Heimat.
These are German newsreel narrators describing German troops entering Paris and the fall of the French government. A German supporter, Marshal Pétain, took control of the French government, and France, beaten and crushed, was forced to sign a peace treaty with Hitler. Now it was just Britain alone against Hitler and his Axis allies. Only the English Channel separated the British people from a German army that seemed unbeatable. British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain was forced to resign. The British people turned to a new leader, Winston Churchill.
I speak to you for the first time as Prime Minister in a solemn hour for the life of our country, of our empire, of our allies, and above all, of the cause of freedom. A tremendous battle is raging in France and Flanders. The Germans, by a remarkable combination of air bombing and heavily armored tanks, have broken through the French defenses north of the Maginot Line, and strong columns of their armored vehicles are ravaging the open country, which for the first day or two was without defenders. They have penetrated deeply and spread alarm and confusion in their track.
Churchill would prove to be strong and brave in the long months ahead. The British would need strong leadership. Hitler wasted no time in launching a fierce air attack on Britain. Throughout the summer, German and British planes fought above the English Channel. All of this military action had an important effect on American popular opinion. War and neutrality were no longer just ideas to be discussed and debated. Now they were real concerns, real events. Fascist troops, led by a dictator in Berlin, were defeating one friendly democracy after another, and Soviet forces were on the march, too. Most Americans still wanted neutrality. But how long could America remain at peace? And was peace worth the cost of just sitting by and watching friends like France and Britain being bombed and invaded? Other issues melted away as Americans began to consider what to do about the darkening world situation. Some Americans, led by newspaper publisher William Allen White, called for the United States to help Britain immediately. But other groups, like the America First Committee, demanded that the United States stay out of another bloody European conflict. The struggle between those who wanted to help Britain and those who wanted to remain neutral did not follow traditional party lines. Some of the strongest supporters of Roosevelt's foreign policies were Republicans. Some members of his own Democratic Party opposed his policies. Even so, foreign policy was one of the main issues in the presidential election campaign of 1940. The Democrats once again nominated Franklin Roosevelt for president. The Republicans had several popular candidates who were interested in campaigning against Roosevelt. At first, it seemed that these candidates would fight it out in a bitter nominating convention in Philadelphia. But to everyone's surprise, a little-known candidate named Wendell Willkie suddenly gained a great deal of support and won the nomination.
For the building of an adequate defense, so that no dictator, however strong, may seek to strike, for the unity of our people, for calling again America to its great tradition of progress, I pledge myself to you, and I ask each of you to join with me in this great crusade.
Willkie was a tough candidate. He was friendly a good businessman, and a strong speaker. He seemed honest, and he seemed to understand foreign policy. Most importantly, Wilkie had a progressive record on many social issues. He was not the kind of traditional conservative Republican that Roosevelt had defeated so easily in his first two campaigns. Instead, Wilkie could claim to represent the average American just as well as Roosevelt, and he offered the excitement of a change in leadership. While Roosevelt and Wilkie began their campaign battles with words, German and British planes were fighting real battles with bullets over the English Channel. Winston Churchill sent a desperate message to Roosevelt. The British Prime Minister said Britain could not fight alone much longer. It needed help immediately. Roosevelt did not want to take steps toward war just before an election, but neither could he refuse such an urgent appeal from the British leader. Roosevelt and Wilkie discussed the situation. Wilkie agreed not to criticize Roosevelt when the president sent 50 ships to the British Navy. He also supported Roosevelt's order for American young men to give their names to Army officials so they could be called up if fighting began. In this way, Roosevelt and Wilkie tried to keep America's growing involvement in the war from becoming a major political issue in the election. President Roosevelt won the election of 1940. He won 27 million votes to 22 million for Wilkie. This made Roosevelt the first and only president in American history to win a third term in the White House. The Constitution was later changed to limit presidents to two terms. Soon after the election, President Roosevelt received a letter from Winston Churchill. The British Prime Minister wrote that Britain urgently needed more arms and planes to fight Germany. Roosevelt agreed. He went to the Congress to plead for more aid to Britain. He said the United States should change its neutral policy because Britain was fighting a common enemy of democracy. Roosevelt also said the United States could avoid war if Britain was strong enough to defeat Germany by itself. Congress agreed, after a fierce debate, to increase aid to Britain. And in the weeks and months that followed, the United States moved closer and closer to open war with Germany. In March of 1941, Roosevelt allowed British ships to come to American ports to be repaired. In June, the United States seized ships under German control. It also took over German and Italian funds in American banks. Open fighting could not be prevented with this increase in tension between Germany and the United States. In September 1941, a German submarine fired at an American ship. The ship was not damaged, but a number of American troops were killed in other naval incidents that followed. By the end of 1941, the United States and Germany were almost at war. Even so, most Americans continued to hope for peace. In fact, few Americans could guess that war was just days away. The first blow would come not from Germany, however, but from Japan.
That's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.